Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Thursday, the 30th of September, 1999. We're in the Village Center this morning as Dr. Ted Peters presents The Eschatology of Human Dignity. Your session number is Lens 99-8. Let's listen in.
Good morning. When people find out that I teach in Berkeley, they sometimes say, and quite frequently just think, well, that's where all those liberals are. And I don't know if the shoe fits it or not, but I've come up with my litmus test to distinguish a liberal from a conservative. A liberal takes the Book of Jonah figuratively and the Song of Solomon literally, and a conservative takes the Song of Solomon figuratively and the Book of Jonah literally. So, let me say something about the journal Dialogue that I edit. The winter issue coming up in January will take up the issue of time and eternity with a number of articles on that particular topic. That'll be the theme. In the spring, theme is going to be sin. And Mary Lowe, whom some of you have met here today, has written a very fine article surveying the concept of sin and various contemporary feminist thinkers. And anyway, those are the first two themes of the year 2000. Some have become aware that earlier this year, Dialogue had a financial cash flow problem, which put the future of the journal in jeopardy, but that has been solved. Blackwell, a publisher in Great Britain, is taking over the subscriptions and the administration of Dialogue. The editorial office is going to be moved entirely to the Lutheran Seminary in Berkeley, and Dialogue will continue. So it's one of those journals that I think every Lutheran pastor ought to have coming into the study for good theology and responsible thinking about the life of the church. Dialogue is produced by theologians for whom the life of the church is vitally important. It's read predominantly by pastors and lay leaders for whom a serious theological reflection is important. Somebody gave me a copy of Forbes magazine to take a look at, and it's quite relevant to a number of articles in here, quite relevant to the topics of this week. I had mentioned yesterday the field of sociobiology, which tends towards genetic reductionism, that is to say, to explain all of human behavior, even complex cultural human behavior, as genetic expression based on the theory that the selfish gene wants to do one and only one thing, and that is to perpetuate itself from generation to generation. Everything that we know of as culture, according to this view, is pressed into the service of the gene's march through history. So we get a little article in Forbes magazine, Forbes Technology magazine, called Hardwired for God. The word hardwired these days refers to a biological predisposition that's built into us. And it's written by Edward O. Wilson, who is not a Master of Divinity kind of theologian. He studies ants. And on the basis of his studies of ants, he feels that he can explain human religion. It's called the naturalistic hypothesis. The naturalistic hypothesis, arising from scientific knowledge, holds that the powerful emotions of religious experience, note he doesn't think of religion as rational, right? Belongs on the emotional side of the ledger. The powerful emotions of religious experience are entirely neurobiological. That they evolved as part of the programmed activity of the brain favoring survival of tribe and individual, and that the particular form they have taken was therefore shaped by the long and idiosyncratic genetic history of the human species. Now, what's going on in this kind of literature and in a very widespread debate is the attempt to explain religious phenomena in general as reducible in, or in terms of, exhaustively in terms of biology, whether it be genetics or whether it be brain activity. And I'm going to talk about brain activity in a little bit. It's reductionistic in character. Yet it's a powerful theory. It seems to explain a lot. And it claims to be scientific. As I mentioned yesterday, in my judgment, the science is very thin. That doesn't mean that it isn't an interesting and compelling theory, but the science upon which it's based is quite insufficient, in my judgment, to warrant those kinds of extravagant claims. But it's very widespread, and it's going to really require some response as we try to think about it. Also, I think there's a subtlety in here, and you'll see this in a couple minutes as I try to say what I think is important about the Christian understanding of resurrection, is that even if such a theory were to prove itself as credible eventually, so that we end up describing things that we previously thought were precious in terms of culture or in terms of our psychic life, that doesn't necessarily falsify what we have thought to be the nature of God and God's relationship to us. I think as Christians in general, Lutherans in particular, being embodied creatures is not anathema to us. In fact, it's something that we celebrate on the grounds that God has not only created the physical order, but loved it enough to become a part of it in the incarnation. So we need not necessarily see a strong embracing of the physicality of human nature as itself problematic. I think whenever reductionism tends towards atheism, you've got big problems. Then I want to just mention one other item in here. I'm not advertising for Forbes magazine, really I'm not, but it's an interesting issue. And it's an article by Anna Fürst, and I don't know if very many of you know Anna. She happens to be a Lutheran systematic theologian trained in Germany, and she works at MIT in the area of artificial intelligence. And while doing that, she also works for us at the Center for Theology and Natural Sciences in Berkeley. It's nice to have a job with two jobs 3,000 miles apart. Anna writes an article here about artificial intelligence, and there's an important debate going on with artificial intelligence that is theologically relevant, and it's the question as to whether or not you can have intelligence without a body. The assumption that many make in the artificial intelligence area is that if we could put a brain in a computer, and if it were to become self-conscious, that it would look very human. Anna disagrees. She says, no, what we know of as intelligence must be embodied. And so what they've done there at MIT is to put computers in physical contraptions that are like bodies. That is to say, they have sensors and they move around and they bump into things, and then these sensors communicate information to the computer. In fact, in the case of COG, there's not just one computer, but a bunch of little computers in various extremities within the robot, so that experience, physical experience, is being absorbed and cataloged by the various computers so that it's self-educating. The robot is self-educating, not simply responding to human programming. And so Anna's argument, and those of her colleagues there at MIT, is that intelligence, even to be intelligence, must be embodied in character. As a theologian, she'll also argue that any Christian understanding of redemption or salvation must come with an embodied form to it, and she's a strong advocate of the notion of resurrection of the body. She writes here in this article, "The creation of a humanoid robot is usually either celebrated as proof of human genius, or it's seen as Frankenstein-like nightmare. But Cog," and that's the name of one of her two robots there, "but Cog's real impact may be more subtle. One of the first reactions people have to Cog is fear, fear that it's too much like them. They are taken in by its human-like characteristics. They really have no choice. Human brains are hardwired to react to human faces, be they newborns, chimps, or even robots." She has a second robot there in her lab called Kismet. And Kismet has a face on it. In fact, it's predominantly what it is, a face. And it has eyes, but the eyes are microscopic television cameras, which are communicating to the computer that is in it. And the experiments consist of looking at Kismet, a human face, looking at Kismet and interacting with Kismet and showing it toys and things like that. And it is in the process of building up experiences of reacting to toys through the eyes. At any rate, I say that in part out of interest, but indirectly it really is relevant to the question that we need to ask in terms of theological anthropology. How strong is our commitment to embodiment in terms of understanding human nature? And does it look like it might be reinforced or obviated by what's going on in scientific experimentation? I used to be on a faculty where the president would open each meeting, faculty meeting, by reading his mail. I mean, it was incredibly boring. I feel like I'm reading my mail here, but believe it or not, it's just kind of like all relevant. The current issue of Science and Spirit has an article. It's an interview of V.S. Ramachandran. V.S. Ramachandran is a brain researcher at the University of California at San Diego, and he specializes in dealing with people with epilepsy. And 25% of people with certain forms of epilepsy have religious experiences. And so he wants to try to track these religious experiences on the brain to see what kinds of brain activity is associated, and thinks, of course, he can find actual patterns of brain activity that are connected with these religious experiences, and this warrants some kind of theological thinking about it. And of course, whatever theological position you have, you're going to bring to it will reflect what you find. But the enduring question is, are the scientists going to do our theology for us? Is there enough going on here that perhaps the theologians could just, you know, go on an extended vacation and let the scientists take over the discipline for us? I obviously don't think so. At any rate, Ramachandran says one possibility based upon his research, and this is very speculative, the word "very" appears in italics, is that human beings are hardwired for religious beliefs. There were history of religion scholars at the turn of the century who thought of the human being as being intrinsically religious, homo religiosus. We are human beings who are intrinsically religious. And now that question is back, but it's back it's coming back from the biologists. It's not coming just from religious studies scholars. Richard Dawkins, he quotes, and Richard Dawkins is the evolutionary biologist in Great Britain who's a belligerent atheist, wrote the famous book, The Selfish Gene, and probably is the paradigm of reductionism. Ramachandran says, Richard Dawkins, amongst others, has argued that many basic human propensities are strongly influenced by genes. It's possible that we have neural machinery specified by genes to make us susceptible to religious experience. What is the genetic survival value? That's the big question if you're a sociobiologist, that genes want human beings to survive so that they themselves can perpetuate themselves. In the old question of what came first, the chicken or the egg, the answer, for the sociobiologist's point of view, it's the egg that comes first. The chicken is just an egg's way of making more eggs. And according to this view, the human being is only a gene's way of making more genes. So that's the theory that he's working with. It's possible that we have neural machinery specified by genes to make us susceptible to religious experience. What is the genetic survival value of Lutheranism? Right? Well, obviously, religion encourages conformist behavior, adherence to a tribe, a clan, loyalty to others who are like you. There is the priesthood, the hierarchy, following a prophet, the ritual chanting. All of this is conducive to the stability of society, which in turn would tend to propagate those genes which promote stability. That's why these religion genes, or this God module in the brain, the G-spot, could have evolved. Now, I just have to make an aside about this theory, is that one of the reasons why I think the theory fails is that it tries to explain everything. In Ramachandran's view, it explains social stability, right? We have social stability because the genes want to propagate themselves. But war gives exactly the same explanation. The reason we have war is that one clan or tribe goes out to defeat the other one, massacre them so that their own genes become the ones that get perpetuated. So if you can explain both war and peace by the same theory, I just think there's something a little wrong about the theory. Okay, finally, now Ramachandran is getting pushed about the relationship between science and religion, and it gets quite diplomatic. It's one thing to debate whether God exists or not, a debate that will go on forever. And there's no way you can resolve that scientifically. You can't approach God scientifically. But we can approach religious experience scientifically and ask which parts of the brain are involved. Well, there's something sober and realistic, I think, about that. That doesn't mean we won't ever be able to say something about God scientifically, but I think at least for the time being, he's going to back off and not try to get a patent on everything that is of religious nature. Well, all of that is really part of a large part of what I want to say today about embodiment, and take a look specifically not at brain research per se, but at about thinking about brain research, the kind of thinking that's going on. And let me give you another example of reductionism, and that's the Nobel Prize winning geneticist Francis Crick. Francis Crick, along with James Watson, were the discoverers of the double helix structure of the DNA back in the 1950s. They won a Nobel Prize for it. Francis Crick, very much like Richard Dawkins, is one of these British belligerent atheists basing the atheism upon science. And he wrote a book a couple of years ago called The Astonishing Hypothesis. And he writes, it has to do with the human brain. Francis Crick writes, "The astonishing hypothesis is that you, your joys and your sorrows, your memories and your ambitions, your sense of personal identity and free will are in fact no more than the behavior of a vast assembly of nerve cells and their associated modules." It's an aggressive materialism here at work, and what you and I experience on a day-to-day basis as mind, as free will, and perhaps in this case even the emotions that go with it, and certainly our belief systems, are all really epiphenomena. They are all really reducible to the neurons firing in our brains. Well, It is with this kind of challenge in mind that my colleagues and I at the Center for Theology and the Natural Sciences in Berkeley thought we might want to look into this and see what is going on, if anything. And we have a program that began in 1987, will run through the year 2000. We call it affectionately our Vatican Conferences, but we work in partnership with the Vatican Observatory in Rome on the question of divine action. How does God act in the natural world? And every 2 years, we get together a team of about 20 scholars, 8 to 10 natural scientists who are specialists in a certain area, and we always try to have some of the world's premier scientists in a given area, and put them together with systematic theologians and philosophical theologians and sometimes some ethicists to engage in what, you know, some kind of dialogue in an attempt to work on the question, how is it that God acts in the natural world? Well, in 1996, we gathered this group together. We had about 7 or 8 neuroscientists in a room with about a dozen theologians, and we were asking these neuroscientists to report on their research and what the implication really is for understanding human nature. Well, this dialogue did not go very well. Some of our dialogues go quite well, but this one was not going very well. And there was pushes, and there were tugs, and skirmishes, and we couldn't figure out initially just what was going on and where the scraping was happening. These neuroscientists, for the most part, with one exception, did not seem to be reductionistic in character in themselves, but there was not much mutual understanding. So we had to have a special session in which to sort out, why is this dialogue not happening? This is about 3 days into a 5-day seminar. And we had Joseph Ledoux, a very widely read neuroscientist from France, and some others. And it turned out that this was the answer, that the actual researchers on the brain have very specific research projects, highly focused research projects. They don't ask the question about what human nature is. They only want to know what's happening in the amygdala or something like that. They're really not asking about human nature in general, or if they're studying an emotion, or if they're studying a particular disease. Their research projects are so focused that they don't ask philosophical questions. And we theologians, we want to jump in, we want to get the big picture about what human nature is, and that was where the difficulty arose. And once we kind of identified the difficulty and knew which agendas were, well, then the dialogue could pick up. Well, I think that's significant for what's going on in when you get to the published literature level. There's a difference between, or there's a distance between the actual researcher and those who think about it. And I've started working with some vocabulary differences. The neuroscientists are those basic researchers who have highly focused research agendas. The cognitive scientists could be people who don't even look at a brain ever, but they look at artificial intelligence, or they look at statistics, or they look at thought patterns, or whatever. And then you've got the cognitive theorists, who are really philosophers, who are a mile or two away from the research science. That's where the reductionism comes in. When Francis Crick makes this remark that everything about us is reducible to our biology, that is not a scientific statement. That doesn't rise out of scientific research. That's a superimposition upon it that's coming from a much more ideological level. At least that's my observation. And I think we need to just wait and see how the research is going to pan out over the next decade or two to see just how much biological reductionism will finally be warranted. Now, what I began to see, let me just point to one item here on the outline, Descartes' error. When you get to the level of the philosophical battle, what seems to be the issue is whether or not there is a disembodied soul. What seems universally anathema is what is called Cartesian philosophy, Descartes' philosophy. And it appears at the first level that what people are objecting to, or what philosophers are objecting to, is substance dualism, that somehow or other the physical world is one substance, and that the mind or the soul is of another substance, and these two are radically opposed to one another, and it's that which permits the soul to go on and have its existence independently of the body. And you'll see in this literature attacks against religion in general and Christianity in particular, because allegedly Christians believe in this kind of substance dualism. Within the arena of the research, something else is going on, not that. What's going on in the arena of the research is the question of the relationship between the mind and the emotions. And what the brain researchers are looking for, among other agendas, is to find out how you can map emotions on the brain, and how the emotional activity of the brain affects the thinking, the abstract thinking, the ability to solve problems, etc. And so the Cartesian error with which they feel that they are working, or they believe they are working, is the question as to whether or not you can have a mind at work that's not contaminated by feeling. And what the brain researchers are saying is no. Any intelligent, any activity of human intelligence is already imbued with feeling, and feeling is biological in character. Now, I find that interesting, but note two slightly different but overlapping agendas, the one within brain research, and then the one that the philosophers pick up on as a nice handy way of ridiculing religion. One of the researchers that we had work with us is a woman named Leslie Brothers, who is a professor of psychiatry at the University of Southern California, but she also does laboratory research on rhesus monkeys. And she is among those who want to argue that we are hardwired for interacting with faces. Remember, that's what Anna First was assuming at MIT in her work with artificial intelligence. And that's corroborated by Leslie Brothers' work with monkeys, that monkeys also interact with one another in terms of facial expressions. And she said that that facial expressions, which you might think of as are internal, are really social in character. She says that if you secretly watch a golfer and the ball has gone into the rough, and then the next shot the ball goes into the rough, if the golfer is alone, he frowns. But if one of his golfing mates is close by, he smiles. To me, it didn't take a professor of psychiatry to tell me about that difference. Another interesting discovery that she found is that emotions, as we know them, do not map on the brain. There certainly is brain activity when we are experiencing emotion, but no matter how you try to set up an experiment, you cannot get what we identify as the various emotions to map with certain brain activity. If you take fear, which is a rather significant human emotion, or love, or affection, or anger, We know these as discrete emotions. We can separate them in our own minds. But you can't go to one part of the brain and say, here's anger, and over here is love, and over here is fear. There is no pattern for that. So Leslie Brothers' conclusion is that, yes, what we know of as emotion arises from brain activity, but the actual structure or form these emotions take are social in character, that they're interactive in character. Well, that's the kind of debate or conversation that goes on within the brain researchers, but we need to ask theologically, and I have that little question down there, is Descartes' error, if there is such an error, is that a Christian error too? I think not. I think that there is at least one way of reading Christian history in which a commitment to embodiment or an understanding of human nature in terms of embodiment is very strong. And when it comes very specifically to our understanding of salvation, of resurrection, that it's the resurrection of the body, or in some of the ancient writings, it's even resurrection of the flesh is what it is that that we affirm. You can find not just resurrection of the soma in the patristics, but occasionally you can find resurrection of the sarx. So committed has the Christian tradition been to an embodied, not just in this life, but the next life as well. What I would like, at any rate, I've just mentioned an interesting book, or an interesting author, if it's one that you haven't run into, is Carolyn Walker Bynum at Columbia, who has tried to track this history. In one of her earlier works dealing with the notion of the body in resurrection thought in the first 14 or 15 centuries of Christian history, she writes, "The materialism of this eschatology expressed not body-soul dualism, but rather a sense of self as psychosomatic unity. The idea of person bequeathed by the Middle Ages to the modern world was not a concept of soul escaping body or soul using body. It was a concept of self in which physicality was integrally bound to sensation, emotion, reasoning, identity, and therefore finally to whatever one means by salvation." She looked, as a historian, she looks not just at what the systematic theologians say, but she also looks at widespread belief and liturgy, ritual practice, and all of those kinds of things for that, which just reminds me, as I'm thinking here, when I took over a parish as pastor in New Orleans some years ago, and maybe I was the second day in my office, and the secretary said that Carter Hinson would like to talk with you, Pastor. And I said, "Well, send Mr. Hinson in." So he came in and he introduced himself and he said, "Pastor, we got a real big problem in this congregation." And I said, "Well, what is this problem?" He says, "Well, a lot of people in this congregation believe in the immortality of the soul, but we believe in the resurrection of the body, don't we, Pastor?" And I said, "Well, yes, Carter, we do." And I thought some pastor had gotten to him earlier. And Carter asked me if I would join him in trying to reteach the congregation the proper belief about resurrection versus immortality of the soul. At that moment, I remembered being in graduate school and hearing Langdon Gilkey lecture on this. And Gilkey argued, of course, this is the Christian belief in resurrection of the body. But he says, "I can't see why people get so excited about the difference between resurrection of the body or the immortal soul." He said, "I'll take either one." Well, the point I want to make thus far is that I think that there is a modest convergence between our classic Christian commitments on the one hand to an embodied reality, both in this life and in the next, as well as an emerging conviction in the sciences that intelligence, emotion, and all of these kinds of things are complex, embodied states of existence. But as we move towards trying to clarify what it is that we mean by resurrection of the body, a number of what I call knotty issues arise that require some sort of conceptual attention. And let me just mention four of them. The first one is the one I just mentioned about our commitment to the body, and even getting a little bit more radical to the flesh. How is that going to look? Because so much of our activity, our mental activity, our spiritual activity, appears to be from a self that can look at our bodies somewhat independently. Even though we're very dependent upon our bodies, we can get some distance. You can look at yourself in the mirror. You can imagine yourself in other situations. You can remember who you were. You can have an expectation of who you're going to be. That our minds clearly transcend our bodies. They might be dependent upon our bodies, but we do really experience some kind of transcendence. It's easy to see why. People might come up with the notion of an independent soul over against the body. Also, when you think about the classic understanding of the spiritual task, you can see it reflected in St. Paul, but certainly the horizon of Stoicism in the ancient world saw a higher and a lower nature, and the lower nature comes from physical desire. And the higher nature, the intellectual nature, is always trying to get control of this lower nature. And you can see this wrestling going on in St. Augustine. In the case of St. Paul in the book of Galatians, well, the Spirit will help us to get control of the desires that arise from the sarks, from the flesh. Yet Christian spirituality is not simply that. There is also within us the desire to have our desire actually desire God. I mean, this is the way finally St. Augustine resolves it. The highest form of desire is to have the whole of me, which includes my body and all of its desires, oriented towards God. That this kind of thinking includes the desires of the body aimed towards that which transcends our body and transcends our own personhood. So even though it's resurrection of the body that we're after, it's a complex thing to think about. At any rate, number two, the second knotty issue that has really been with us for a long time, and it's the question as to whether or not survival or beyond death or immortality is a natural thing, or whether it has to be an act of God. One of the difficulties that our ancient Christian forebears had about the doctrine of the immortal soul is that the immortal soul, as posited by the Greeks, is a metaphysical entity. You have an immortal soul, it belongs to you, and when you die, your soul runs off and does other things. It's a natural phenomenon. It's a metaphysical reality. You don't really need God to survive death with that kind of a doctrine. The Christian understanding of things is that when Jesus rose from the dead on Easter Sunday, it was an act of God. Jesus didn't go into the grave, so to speak, with some built-in capacity to bounce back. That the act of God in raising Jesus from the dead was tantamount to calling the world into creation out of nothing prior to that. Your and my hope for an eschatological resurrection is really based upon an eschatological act of God. It's not based upon something that's intrinsic in human nature. Another knotty problem that has to be thought about is the question of continuity of identity. Continuity of identity. This is a tougher one. What's going to be raised? If you think about St. Paul in 1 Corinthians 15, he uses the seed analogy. He thought that seeds were dead. So the seed is dead, and you bury it in the ground, kind of like having a funeral. It's dead. It's gone. Well, then the next, the seed sprouts up, and you have new life. It's new life, but it's the same seed. And so that becomes an extended metaphor that St. Paul uses as we move from a physical body to a spiritual body in 1 Corinthians 15. Well, how much connection or continuity is there between what got buried on the one hand and what gets raised on the other? If you have a radical split so that absolutely nothing that got buried is present then in the resurrection, then how do you know it's you or me in the resurrection? If it's radical and if it's total, then we might as well drop into the non-being of the past and God can start over with somebody else brand new. So there's got to be some continuity. Yet, St. Paul says, flesh and blood, in the natural sense, cannot inherit the kingdom of God. There's got to be a transformation. I find this to be conceptually a very difficult one with which to work, especially if we press the interaction or the interrelationship between our bodies and our spirits. Now, one could say, well, what God could do, if God is really a very clever engineer, is go back and find all of the physical elements that belong to our bodies and then put them back together again in the resurrection. Clean them up a little bit spiritually, put it back together. But then that leads to the fourth and final of the knotty problems, the problem of chain consumption. Who are we, physically speaking? Are we unique physical entities in which we, so to speak, own the properties of our own bodies? Well, not exactly. If you think about how we are over a lifetime, we eat and we expel, right? The things that we expel, are they part of our identity? Hope not, right? What about the food we're going to eat tomorrow that we've not yet eaten? Is that part of our identity? Is it necessary for us to be who it is that we are? A big problem that the ancient Christians confronted was cannibalism. What happens if one human being eats another human being? Now, this was a bit of a theoretical problem for the ancient Christians, but it had a practical correlate, and that was Christians dying, being eaten by wild animals such as lions in the Roman rings. What happens if a Christian goes to death and is eaten by a lion, and then his or her body becomes part of the lion's physiognomy in one fashion or another? Or what happens if you and I were accidentally to kill that lion out in the wild and eat it? Not only have we eaten a lion, but we ate one of our martyrs. So St. Augustine tackles this problem. St. Augustine solves the problem this way. Oops, excuse me. Reminds me of my first sermon in seminary. It was high pressure in seminary, and you had to preach before the entire seminary community. And I was very nervous about this, and I had my manuscript all typed out. I rehearsed it day after day. Even my wife would go into the chapel. We'd go in late at night with nobody there, and I'd read through this sermon, and she would comment. And I put in a gesture. I stood there like this, right? and I had a gesture in there, right? And remember the old U.S. government army advertisements where Uncle Sam wants you? That was my gesture. I was going to go like this. Now, I rehearsed the sermon in my shirt, right? But on the day in which I preached, I had to come up. St. Augustine solves the problem of chain consumption by arguing that the body in the resurrection belongs to the original person who first had the body. So if you get eaten by somebody else, you get your own body back. For all the flesh which hunger had consumed finds its way into the air by evaporation, whence God Almighty can recall it. That flesh, therefore, shall be restored to the person in whom it first became human flesh, for it must be looked upon as borrowed by the other person, and like a pecuniary loan, that's money, a loan, it must be returned to its lender. So if you get eaten by a cannibal, you'll get it back in the resurrection. The contemporary version of the chain consumption problem is made much more complex with our knowledge of evolution and the long time span. And we can imagine that the physical elements in the soil that become the plants, that become the flesh, is cycled again and again and again, and locating the first person would be kind of tough, right? And then what happens if the first person gets it all? Those of us for hundreds of thousands of years later don't have anything left. Arthur Peacock, the systematic theologian at Oxford, who does a lot of work in theology and science, takes this up. He says, it is only too clear that the constituents of human bodies are at death irreversibly dispersed about the globe, eventually contributing to the bodies of other later persons as well as other living organisms. Hence, the actual transformation of individual human bodies could not itself secure the continuity of personal identity through death. Transformation, understood as merely immortalizing our mortal bodies, is conceptually inadequate, because over time we share the elements of our bodies with other creatures. Thus, an adequate conceptual account must include a component of new creation, a recreation into a new mode of existence. It seems to me that even though that does not completely solve the problem, the whole notion of recreation needs to be built in. Well, I want to make one final point. By the way, I don't have to solve every problem I raise, do I? I want to raise one final point that I do not see discussed very often in systematic theology, but for me it's been one of the insights of Dr. Pannenberg over the years that I think really needs serious consideration, and that's the notion of wholeness over a period of time. If you ask the question, who am I or who are you at any given moment, Is that what defines you? Or who are we at the moment of our death? Is that what defines us? Is that what God raises from the dead? And it's particularly difficult when we think that we might die in circumstances that really are not indicative of who it is that we have been throughout our life. And when we think of eschatological consummation, when we think of life in God's kingdom, everlasting kingdom, as fulfillment, then it can't just be a slice of our life. It's got to be the whole of who we are. And I asked Dr. Pannenberg if I could tell the following story. He said yes. Some years ago, when Dr. Pannenberg visited Berkeley, we went out for breakfast before church, and at that time his mother was still alive. She's passed away. But in her later years, she was in a nursing home suffering from Alzheimer's disease, and he reported how he would go weekly to visit her, And her memory was not working very well. And even though she could remember who Wolfhart was as a young boy, she couldn't remember the contemporary circumstances. And this was emotionally difficult to deal with. But then he reflected in a way that I find consistent with his systematic theology. He said, "Who is my mother? Is my mother only the woman who lays in the bed there in the nursing home suffering from memory loss? Or is my mother the younger woman who raised me as a little boy and helped me to go to school and taught me these things? Or is my mother the woman she was when she was a little girl at her mother's knee and on down the line?" And his conclusion was, and I found very convincing, my mother is all of these things. My mother is her whole biography. And when we talk about resurrection of the dead as redemption and as fulfillment, it is the whole of who it is that we are. And it just seems to me that that's so fitting when it comes to looking ahead at what St. Paul promises in 1 Corinthians 15. It is the whole of who we are that is intended by the notion of the soma pneumatikon, spiritual body. And that all of those things are co-present, and they're co-present in a meaningful fashion. Conceptually, it's going to be hard to work that one out. Be that as it may, that is still God's promise to us, and it's a wonderful thing to look forward to. Thank you so much for your attention. Did you want to come up?
We have about 5 minutes. If you would like to ask Dr. Peters a question, there's one back there.
Yeah, I meant, when I used the word transcend there, I meant it in a very, very modest sense of consciousness or awareness of oneself, and that means not being stuck in oneself. I tend to be a holist, as I think perhaps you were indicating there, in saying that the whole is greater than the sum of the parts, that who you and I are is a self, is certainly totally and exhaustively dependent upon our body, but it's more than our body. It's not reducible to our body, and it's the more than that I use the word transcendence for. I would hesitate maybe to go all the way and use what was your word? It was differentiate. I would hesitate to do that because that might indicate a cutting off. Distinguish, yeah, I think we can distinguish the mind from the body. And if differentiate means cognitively understand them as distinct, yeah, I could go with that. Yes, sir.
In mapping out the brain, the emotional field of the brain, the first reflex was not able to do that. How does that fit with some of the things that have been sort of popularly held recently in terms of right brain, left brain, aesthetics and feelings seem to be involved with that differentiation?
This is a good question, and I have posed it actually to some of these brain researchers. In the 1970s and 1980s, I spent a lot of time researching the New Age. And the right brain, left brain distinction was very popular then, and New Agers dumped on it all of these stereotypes that differentiate men from women, you know, so that one side of the brain was male and the other one was female and that kind of thing. Can that really be borne out in neurophysiologically? Probably not. That really was a social construction. But that there are differences between the two brain, the hemispheres of the brain, yes. The amazing thing that the researchers wanted to talk about is that if a function in one side of the brain gets is lost for some reason or another due to damage, that over a period of time in recovery, the other side of the brain picks up those functions. It's one of the fascinating mysteries within the research that you know, kind of keeps brain researchers getting up each morning and wanting to go to the laboratory. Yes, go ahead.
We've been thinking about your comments on chain consumption.
I think I hear a good one coming. Right, right. I think that if you were to extrapolate on your question just a little bit and say, what would happen if we get a merging of psyches? You know, if there's an organ such as a brain or something that gets transplanted, I don't know if there'll ever be brain transplants, but could there be organs that get transplanted that actually influences the psyche of the recipient? There are already suggestions that if you do receive somebody else's organ in a transplant, that some of their bodily knowledge gets transplanted to you. One of the interesting things about Anna First's experiments is that she believes that physiologically that memory is not limited only to the brain, that memory, you can find memory in the hands actually have memory at work in them. And that's why you can do lots of hand movements without thinking about it. You don't have to, the finger doesn't need to ask the brain permission for certain kinds of activity. So you may end up with an organ transplant in which some of that memory is actually at work in your body. So now the question is, are you alone there? And what about the resurrection? Maybe Dr. Ponenberg could speak to this, but one of the ways we think about the resurrection is that we're one in the body of Christ. And I'm not sure that our concept of resurrection requires, you know, kind of autonomous identity. There's definitely has to be continuity of identity. But there's also going to be some dimension of it in which we are going to be sharing what is essential to ourselves with others and definitely with Christ. And in that sense, in Christ, sharing it with others. So there may turn out actually to be a theological advantage in this, even though it's too early to tell.